You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 1st, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everybody.
Rebecca has the night off. And next week, we are all departing for TAM, which will be going on by the time this episode goes live.
If you're downloading this and listening to it on Saturday, we'll be at TAM while you're listening to this.
How exciting.
I'm excited. What are you talking about?
Yeah. Evan, what's special about today?
Yeah, so it was 1796 when the first experiment with smallpox inoculation was made by Dr. Edward Jenner of Berkeley, England.
What year?
1796. So, first experiment with smallpox inoculation.
How'd that work out?
Apparently well. He treated both arms of young James Phipps, 8-year-old boy. He was not harmed by the otherwise deadly smallpox material.
Didn't they use the cowpox? Wasn't that the first smallpox vaccine?
Yeah, Jenner had, and according to this, Jenner had previously vaccinated the same boy with cowpox in a few months prior, in May of 1796.
Oh, so he wasn't a naive subject? That's not a good experiment.
Hey, Steve, right. Should... I never got the chicken pox.
You never got chicken pox?
No.
So you'll get shingles?
So do not get exposed to somebody who has it as an adult.
Yeah, so how bad is it for adults? I mean, I understand it's pretty bad. It could actually be really bad if you catch it when you're older.
Yes, it can be extremely bad if you get it when you're older.
Is that what shingles is, Steve?
No, shingles is not getting the chicken pox. Shingles happens in people who have had chicken pox. Some of the virus becomes dormant in the nervous cells in your spinal cord, some of the neurons, and they could become reactivated at a later time, either just because, you know, no particular reason, or under periods of stress, or when you have another infection or whatever. The virus can become activated. Then it comes out of the nerves, which is why you get a rash in what we call a dermatome, right? In a strip of skin that's fed by one of the spinal nerves, you get the shingles rash.
I had it.
But a lot of people don't know is that the virus also can go more centrally into the spinal cord itself. And it can cause a lot of pain. It can cause what's called a postherpetic neuralgia, which is a very severe, very difficult to treat nerve pain from the damage from the reactivated virus.
Really?
Yeah, but that's a reactivation of the dormant virus. It's not an acute infection. You can only get that if you've had chickenpox sometime before in your life. But if you actually get the acute chickenpox infection, it's very serious for an adult, and it could actually cause sterility.
Oh, yeah, Jay.
Wow. Hey, come on. So I better hurry up, huh?
But on to some actual news items. We have...
That was a news item.
We have Phil Plait joining us in just a moment to go over a series of astronomy news items this week. But first, a couple of non-astronomy news items. We have been following the story of the Irish company Stern for a few years now on this show. They announced that they had developed an energy-generating technology, their so-called Orbo technology. And this has been a series of disasters. Actually, the typical stuff that we've come to expect from companies or individuals who promise that right around the corner they're going to present a demonstration of a free energy machine. It never seems to come to pass. If you recall, it was in summer of 2007 that they had their, in July, in fact, they had their promised demonstration. And, hey, you know, I know you're skeptical, but we've had experts look at this. This really works. We're going to show the world this Orbo technology, free energy. Here you go. Total failure. Didn't work. And they just had excuses about why it didn't work, but not, you know, they never admit that their core concept is flawed. There was just these other technical glitches. They pushed off the demonstration. Well, now it's 2 years later. We never have seen a demonstration from them. They've never been able to show that their concepts are correct or that their technology works. The news item that came out at the end of June is that the company actually hired an independent panel or jury of experts, 22 scientists with appropriate backgrounds, to August of 2006 to investigate their technology and their claims. And the jury just came back with their results. They said, here's from the press release from this panel of experts, 22 independent scientists and engineers were selected by Stern to form this jury. It has, for the past 2 years, examined evidence presented by the company. The unanimous verdict of the jury is that Stern's attempts to demonstrate the claim have not shown the production of energy. The jury is therefore ceasing work.
Wah, wah, wah.
Case closed.
No
shock there. Right? That's the way these things always turn out. With the absence, obviously so far, with the absence of free energy, not a surprise. It's actually interesting this company went as far as to, you know, point these 22, it seems, legitimately independent scientists and gave them access to some of their material enough that they can come to a decision. Now, you would think after that, the company would say, okay, I guess we made a mistake. I guess, you know, maybe we're missing something. We'll have to go back to the drawing board. Something a little conciliatory. Although, you know, I don't really think they would do that, but you would hope in a perfect world something like that would happen.
Excuse me, merely regret.
Yeah, but no. No, now it's excuse time, right? It's special pleading time.
Yep, special pleading.
Yeah, here we go.
Predicted that too, yeah.
So this is what Sean McCarthy, who's the CEO of Stern, says. Due to these difficulties, we had focused on providing the jury with test data related to the underlying magnetic effect behind Orbo. This work concluded at the end of 2008. But then he said during 2009, the company had resolved the key technical problems related to the implementation of Orbo and is now focused on commercial launch towards the end of this year, at which time academic and engineering validation would be released concurrent with public demonstrations. So what he's basically saying is that the information given to the jury of 22 experts only included the work they had done through the end of 2008. But actually in 2009, they solved all the problems. But the jury did not have access to all of their fixes. That's why they said it doesn't work. But now they really have it working. And by the end of this year, they're going to have technical validation and public demonstrations. So they just kicked that can down the road for another 6 months or so. And
really kicked your ass.
We really did it this time. Unbelievable. That's that. But that's the cycle. So now we've seen the absolute complete cycle with this company and their free energy claims. This is how the story always goes. It does make you wonder what leads people and companies to this place where they think they've created free energy, but they haven't. This is what I think happens. I do think there's two flavors. There are outright con artists in the game, right? I think we know that.
Of course.
But I do think there are probably more people who just get suckered in by the following sequence of events. They have some notion of a way of generating energy, which is ultimately, in my opinion, naive, you know, in terms of their understanding of physics. But they think that maybe there's some way they could break the laws of thermodynamics or they could tap into some exotic form of energy, and they think they'll be able to generate essentially endless cheap energy.
Something that's been overlooked for generations.
They then do experiments which are designed to establish the basic underlying principle. And in order to rule out every known source of energy, you would have to do the experiments very precisely. Even the slightest error can introduce erroneous sources of energy or just screw up with your measurements or your calculations so that you think that there's a tiny little extra bit of energy in the system when there isn't. They then say, aha, that tiny bit of energy proves that my underlying principle is correct, and therefore I should be able to generate massive amounts of energy, right? I think that's where they're going off the rails. The slight experimental error validating their incorrect hypothesis, which they then extrapolate wildly to, you know, producing energy for the world.
What if they're just stupid, Steve?
That's a simpler explanation, but it's not as satisfying because it doesn't really tell us anything.
Harder to calculate, right?
Right.
They hired these 22 experts to serve as a jury. So what my sense is that this is more of a case of self-deception on their own part rather than trying to pull the wool over everyone else's eyes. Otherwise, why go ahead and actually get 22 experts to to talk about your work.
The vibe I get off this company is that they're just self-deceived, right? Whenever it's a company, from what I've read, I don't think that they're fleecing a lot of investors. But, you know, if anyone looking for investors, you know, maybe. And it's, again, I'm not also trying to pretend like there's a clean separation between the con artists and the true believers. I think people might be cutting corners and, yeah, maybe they're overselling their claims. They might at the core believe they're onto something, but they may be overselling it in order to keep the money flowing to do the research to really solve the problem. You know what I mean? So there could be those that are kind of in the middle, and maybe this is what we're seeing here. They're sort of they know that they're putting off the inevitable here because they need to keep things moving forward, because they may still be holding out this belief that they are onto something and they will be able to solve the problems eventually. But, you know, the free energy community, they still are touting this is it. It's really going to happen this time, and we're going to have egg all over our face. And
are we really going to do it this time?
As I wrote about this in my blog, I said, they're convinced that this time the great pumpkin is really going to show up.
Yeah.
You know, but that's kind of the level that we're dealing with here. All right, one more quick news item. This is just a follow-up to the lawsuit, the libel lawsuit between the British Chiropractic Association and Simon Singh. If you recall, Simon wrote in an article that the BCA, the British Chiropractic Association, is promoting chiropractic treatments for certain childhood diseases and disorders like asthma and colic and endotitis media, or middle ear infection, that are quote-unquote bogus, by which he meant they lack evidence. In response to that, the BCA sued Simon Singh rather than saying, oh, well, here's the evidence to show that these treatments work. And this trial is now ongoing. Well, the update on this story is that the BCA has now published what they consider to be a list of publications which provide evidence for the treatments that Simon Singh was criticizing. Their press release has 29 articles cited with a brief description, you know, the full reference and a brief description. Most of the articles that are cited have absolutely nothing to do with the claims that they're making. They're completely ancillary. Like a bunch of them are articles about the risks of aspirin-like drugs, of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Okay, that has nothing to do with whether or not chiropractic works for anything. Others have to do with, like, here's one. Evidence-based medicine is about integrating individual clinical expertise and the best external evidence. Okay, that's not evidence. That's not a study. They do present a few crappy preliminary, you know, unblinded studies that are either so-called pragmatic studies, meaning if a parent takes a child to a chiropractor because they're having colic, the parents think that the children are better afterwards. That's all that the study shows. But it doesn't show efficacy. It doesn't test whether or not the chiropractic manipulation actually works. So the studies that they link to don't actually show that, for example, chiropractic manipulation is effective in the treatment of colic, which is what Simon Singh was talking about. They're more either unblinded, you know, case series, or again these sort of quote unquote pragmatic studies, which are not really able to answer the question of does a treatment work. And very tellingly, they left out the studies which show that chiropractic doesn't work for these indications. They did not cite, for example, the one blinded study of chiropractic manipulation and colic that showed that it does not work. It had no effect, no difference between chiropractic manipulation and placebo. They left that study out. So they cited the crappy low-grade evidence that showed that people feel better, but not that there's really efficacy. And they did not cite the study that showed that it doesn't work.
It's fun to cherry pick.
Right. Same thing is true with asthma. There was, in 1998, a very large collaborative study between chiropractors and MDs of spinal manipulation for childhood asthma, and it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it showed absolutely no effect whatsoever. It doesn't work. That's the best evidence that's out there. So, and again, we see the pattern in this evidence that we see for other placebo or null effects, in that the poor, low-grade studies show mixed results, but a lot of it being positive, but it's basically compatible with a placebo effect. But the better the study, the smaller the effect. And the studies that are actually the only ones designed to test efficacy in a reliable blinded fashion are negative. This is the best that they could do. So here we have the British Chiropractic Association publicly embarrassed and publicly challenged to present the evidence to back up their claims, and this is the best they could do. Crappy, cherry-picked studies. That says something. Horrible. This will deserve a much more in-depth analysis, which I will probably give on my science-based medicine blog, but that's the quickie overview at this point in time. They should be embarrassed that this is the best that they could do. And in my opinion, they proved Simon Singh's point exactly.
Free Simon Singh.
Well, we will track this story. This is, I think, a very important story, the Simon Singh experience with the BCA. I think that elements of it are going well. I think that the good news is that the British Chiropractic Association and a lot of the claims they're making are being exposed to the public as being hollow. The downside is this whole story about the British libel laws, or I should say the English libel laws, and how Simon Singh is being victimized by them. But we will continue to track the story and update you as things happen. Well, it's time for Phil Plait to join us for some astronomy news items, so let's go get him now. Joining us now is the bad astronomer, Phil Plait. Phil, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, hey. That's the best Krusty I can do. I'm just down
bad.
Shut off.
Oh, God. I thought that was King Kong.
We have a backlog of some astronomy news. We thought we'd bring you on for the conversation. A few things. The first one is an update about Enceladus, which is very exciting. It's a moon of Saturn that we've been following the news for a few years about possible liquid water below the surface of Enceladus. And Phil, what's the latest update on that?
Well, the latest update is that Enceladus may or may not have an ocean underneath its surface. And you kind of think, well, that's kind of where we were before, but that's where we still are. The deal is it's a small moon of Saturn. It's an ice ball, and it's been known to have been an ice ball for a long time. I mean, we've known this for years. Now, Cassini is the space probe that's been orbiting Saturn for a few years, and it discovered that there are plumes of water coming from the south pole of this moon, and there are cracks in the ice there. And it has been supposed that, like Europa, which is the moon of Jupiter, Enceladus is probably a giant ball of water with a frozen surface. So it's basically a moon-spanning undersurface ocean, and the ice on the crust is some miles thick. And these geysers are coming from pressure changes or whatever. There are cracks in the ice, and this water is shooting out. Well, there were two studies that were released roughly on the same day, I mean, within a few hours of each other. Basically, one of them said, we detected salt in this water, and the other one said, we did not detect salt in this water, and it's very confusing. And the way they did this, so at the University of Colorado, which is where I live, in Boulder, Colorado, they used ground-based telescopes in the infrared, and they looked for the presence of sodium in the geysers themselves, in these plumes. And they didn't find any. And so they thought, aha, if this is just fresh water, basically pure water, then it should not be an underground ocean. You'd expect there to be salt dissolved in this water if it's a moon-spanning ocean. And they didn't see it. So therefore, it's probably not an ocean, and there are probably just pockets of liquid water under the surface, like caverns filled with water, and that these cracks don't go all the way through, and that's where the water's coming from. Well, these other guys at JPL and the Max Planck Institute for Nuclear Physics in Germany, they looked at the outermost ring of Saturn. Now, this ring is known to be supplied by these geysers. This water shoots out of Enceladus, it basically freezes and forms this ring around Saturn. So by looking at those rings, they're basically looking at the geysers as well. And what did they find? They found sodium. And so it was a sodium salt that they found in this ring. And therefore, they assume, aha, there is a global ocean underneath the surface of Enceladus. So we have these two studies that came out at the same time, basically contradicting each other. I have not heard what the deal is. You know, both of them may be right. There may be different conditions going on. There may be some third possibility. It may be there is an ocean, but what forms the rings is different. I don't know. But, you know, here is science in action. When you're doing cutting-edge stuff, you get ambiguous results sometimes, and you got to keep studying it to figure out what's going on.
Could the salt be in such low concentration that they couldn't detect it? It wasn't sensitive enough to detect the low concentration?
Well, that was my thought as well. If you're looking in the infrared from the Earth, there are all sorts of problems with it. And when you have a non-detection, when they're looking at the geysers themselves and they don't detect something, yeah, it's a little, you know, you kind of think, well, maybe it's not as solid a result as finding what you're looking for. When you find what you look for, it's a little more positive. If you don't find what you're looking for, maybe you're not looking hard enough. Maybe it's someplace else. Maybe there's something going on that you're missing. So not finding something sort of raises more questions than finding it. So if I had to say one of these is right, one of these is wrong, you know, I'd say, well, probably the ground-based study is not right. But I can't say that because I don't know all the details of these studies. And I suspect it's going to be something else that we still have to look at. Somebody's going to come along and say, you know, we didn't think about this. And then we have to look at this. And when they do that, it'll clear things up. But for right now, as far as I can tell, we've got two different answers.
Phil, is sodium the only other element that they're looking for? Can they be looking for something, a trace element of something else to try to help determine what's going on?
Actually, I don't know. You might expect there could be chlorine or something else present in this water. But I would think, you know, given what's going on the Earth and the chemistry of the Saturn system, sodium would probably be the most abundant. And knowing astronomers, you know, being one, you look for what's easy first. You know, so if they're looking for sodium, I'm guessing it's because that's what they expected would be the easiest thing to find.
So the situation we have here is we have two different lines of evidence, both trying to infer, really, not directly look, but infer whether or not there's likely to be oceans on Enceladus, and they came up with different answers. So there's some false assumption in one or the other line of evidence. Either the sodium in the ring is coming from somewhere else, or one possibility, I guess, is that the geysers that the ground-based telescopes were looking at were not the same ones as is feeding this ring from Saturn. So maybe there's both. Maybe there's geysers coming from some superficial pockets that don't have sodium, and then occasionally there are geysers coming from deeper down a salt ocean that do have sodium and that are feeding the ring, right?
Maybe. I don't know of any other geysers on Enceladus but these ones at the South Pole. Another possibility is that there's a time dependency to these, and yeah, that what yeah. formed the rings, I don't know, thousands, millions of years ago, whenever, the sodium content was higher. And now the geysers are more deficient in sodium. I don't know, and it's pretty interesting.
Hey, Phil, what's the significance of sodium?
It's salty.
Yeah, it's salty.
Let's say in this context.
Yeah, in this context, I'm guessing it has to do with – you see, I'm not a planetologist. I like to study stars that blow up and things that can kill us. Enceladus has a very low probability of killing us, even lower than a supernova or gamma ray burst. But unless you watch Impact, which I believe we'll be talking about later as
oh.
well. But in this case, they're expecting that these moons are not all one thing. It's not that this is a giant ball of water with a crust over it. There's probably a core that's rocky. You would expect some when this moon formed, there were some accretion, some gathering of different types of materials, including silicates like rock. And that stuff would form the core of this moon, and you would wind up getting the same sort of processes in an ocean on Enceladus that you would on the Earth. And so it would be a salty ocean, and there would be condensation on there, not condensation, but precipitates on the floor. And who knows what these geysers are doing, mixing things up. You know, if this water is convecting, if the hot stuff is rising, the cold stuff is sinking, there's all kinds of crazy stuff that you have to consider when you're looking at this system. It's a very, very complex system. So the sodium, you just expect it there because you would expect the same processes roughly to be going on there that you would on Earth. I don't know what this is telling us. Is it telling us it's a different process? Is it telling us there's a time dependence? Is it telling us that just now when we looked there was no salt, and if we look in a week we'll see it? Or is this on a scale of millions of years? I don't know. But that just shows you that this is it's a crazy place. Saturn is odd. And it's going to take a lot more studying before we can understand what's going on there.
And this is all really cool stuff, but the extra added element here is that we want to know if Enceladus is a likely location where there might be
alien fishies.
Alien life that evolved someplace other than on the Earth, which would be such a boon to science that it's worth paying close attention to.
What I like about this, too, is that even if we find that Europa And we're sure that Europa has water underneath its surface. You can just look at it and say, oh, yeah, that looks just like ice flows in the North Atlantic. You can tell there's that this is ice is floating on water. And in fact, you can see changes in Europa over time as this ice is pushing around on these plates. So we know there's water under there, and Enceladus clearly has water under the surface. And Titan, the largest moon of Saturn, has a thick atmosphere with oceans of ethane on it. And that means there could be complex organic chemistry in the atmosphere and on the surface of Titan. So even if we don't find life, even if we don't find little fishies swimming around or whatever, it shows you that even in these alien worlds, there are conditions where life could arise. And if it doesn't, that tells you something important just as much as if we do find life there.
It's one interesting thing is that it's possible as we start to survey the galaxy for life that we may find that the moons of large gas giants may be a more common location for life than small rocky worlds closer to their suns like our own Earth. Who knows? We just have no data at this point.
I think that's probably the right way to think about it, especially since one planet could have a dozen moons. And so you get a lot more variety in the moon system than you would in the planet itself.
Let's just get some probes down there over there. Come on. I mean, I'd like to focus on that stuff. I mean, the payoff, my God, look at the payoff if you find some sort of bacteria on these other moons. I think we should be really focusing on those moons more than almost anything else.
Well, we'll get right on that. Okay. That's hard to do. It's hard to get your way through a mile-thick shell of ice and probe the ocean underneath the surface and communicate with an orbiter so that it can relay that information back to Earth. That's a tough call. And there are people thinking about how to do that, but I haven't seen anything that is really 100% there yet.
Just send Bruce Willis up there, man. He'll do it.
Yeah, if we blow it up, crack it open, see what's in there. That'll work.
Oh, look what used to be alive
here. Dr. Manhattan.
Cool. Right.
Oh, God.
The next few stories are all about the Earth's moon, which is appropriate because this month, July of 2009, is the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing.
The alleged Apollo landing. Okay.
That's right. I'm willing to go out on a limb with that one. But first, before we talk about that, let's talk about finding uranium on the moon.
Yeah, this was a pretty cool study. I wrote about this, and it turns out I made a couple of mistakes on my blog entry. I hate it when I do that. But, you know, that's science, is admitting your mistakes and moving on. The Kaguya spacecraft, if you pronounce it incorrectly and you say Kaguya, which is how most people say it, that means furniture store in Japanese. It's actually Kaguya spacecraft has a gamma ray detector on it, and this is the highest energy form of light. It's just like the light we see with, except it's supercharged, has a tremendous amount of energy in it. And it takes a certain type of event to create gamma rays, whether it's an exploding star or really strong magnetic fields, or in this case, the fission of elements, of isotopes, of radioactive elements. When uranium splits and then its daughter elements split and it forms uranium and thorium and all this stuff, they emit gamma rays. So by putting a gamma ray detector on an orbiting spacecraft, you can actually see these gamma rays, read their energies, and be able to determine where they came from, whether it was from uranium or thorium or whatever. And what they found was uranium. They found gamma rays that were associated with the daughter elements of uranium on the surface of the moon. And this is the first time this has been done from orbit. It turns out that I didn't realize this. I didn't even know this. Somebody emailed me. Uranium has been found on the moon by studying the rocks that were on the surface. Trace amounts of uranium were found. Not a whole lot, but it's there. This is the first time it's been done from space, which is cool because that means you can map all of this from orbit without having to take rocks from, you know, every square mile of the surface, which is difficult as well as expensive and time-consuming. So they've been able to map, and they found all kinds of radioactive elements. They found uranium. They found, let's see, I've got a list here. Besides uranium, they also found thorium, potassium, oxygen, magnesium, silicon, calcium, titanium, and iron. All of these
like a multivitamin.
Have, yeah, yeah, it's what a growing boy needs, right? All of these have radioactive isotopes that can give off gamma rays, and so that's what they found. What's cool about this is this allows you to map things that they can use. If you're going to colonize the moon, you want to know where the oxygen is. You want to know where the iron is, the titanium especially, if you're going to be building stuff. So this is a kind of a neat thing. If we can put, you know, the next generation gamma ray detectors on there, the better detectors there are, the higher resolution they have, the better we can map this stuff out. Even if you don't want to try to say, well, this has practical benefits because that's expensive and difficult and who knows when we're going to colonize the moon, this does let us know quite a bit about the radioactive content of the moon. And mind you, this isn't like walking through Alamogordo in New Mexico or anything like that. These are really low-level amounts here. But it does tell you how these things got mixed in with the lunar rocks, and it gives us an idea about how the moon formed and how it's changed since it formed. So scientifically, this is a very interesting result, and so it's very cool in that manner.
In terms of how planetary bodies form, the conventional wisdom is that stuff that's really heavy, like iron and certainly uranium, which is very, very heavy, they tend to sink farther down from the surface, maybe even ending up in the core, depending on when they were introduced into the mix. So here we're talking about fairly heavy metals on the surface of the moon. That, again, as you say, that tells us something about the moon, how the moon is formed. And my understanding is that implies that whatever heavy stuff we find on the surface of the moon probably came to that, to the moon, fairly recently, or at least after the moon solidified.
Well, not necessarily. This is where I made my mistake in the blog post. So thanks for bringing that up, Steve.
painful subject.
Yeah, what I was thinking is that, you know, uranium forms into a ball of uranium in it that's very dense, very heavy, so it would sink right through the mantle of the Earth to the core. And we are pretty sure, although there are some issues with this hypothesis, we're pretty sure that the moon formed after the Earth did. The Earth was basically a molten ball, and it started to differentiate. In other words, the heavy stuff had started to sink to the core of the Earth. The lighter stuff, silicates and oxygen and things like that, had floated to the surface of the Earth, and then the Earth got whacked by some Mars-sized planet, which hit this Earth in sort of a grazing collision. So it wasn't a head-on collision. They smacked into each other like two pool balls you're trying to you know, do a corner shot. And this collision splashed off a lot of the lighter elements that were already floating to the surface of the Earth. And that's why the moon has a little bit more than half the density of the Earth. It's roughly half the density of the Earth. And that's because it's made up of all of these lighter things than the Earth is. However, one step more is that you would expect then that the moon would not have much uranium or anything like that, because that stuff would have already sunk to the core of the Earth. But in fact, uranium likes to bond with oxygen, and it forms some strange molecule like U407 or something crazy like that. I don't know the exact ratio, but this is a relatively lighter molecule than uranium itself is. So it would tend to float on the Earth and on the mantle. So in fact, not all the uranium is in the core of the Earth. A lot of it is in the crust of the Earth. And so when this Mars-sized object hit us, this uranium that was floating basically became part of the moon. And so you expect some of that on the surface of the moon, some of it in the core. You know, the moon was molten as well. But again, if the moon differentiated at all, if any of the heavy stuff sank and the lighter stuff floated, you would expect to find uranium on the surface. What'll be interesting is that by knowing how much, by quantifying the amount of uranium, that will help us understand how the moon formed and what happened since, as well as what the Earth was like when this thing smacked us, which was probably only maybe 100 million years after the Earth was formed or less.
Well, Phil, how about a more recent event, something like the asteroid that impacted the Earth 65 million years ago, the dinosaur killer?
Right.
Asteroids spit a lot of stuff up that apparently, you know, some of it dusted the moon.
Probably a little bit did, but I don't think you would expect that much. The Earth has got a very, very steep gravity well, and even an asteroid 10 kilometers across, like the one that wiped out the dinosaurs, most of that stuff would go up in the atmosphere and be on ballistic trajectories. So it would go up in an arc and then fall down someplace else on the Earth. Very little of it would actually get out into orbit. That's not the way the mechanics of it works. So splashing stuff from the Earth to the moon would be very difficult.
So you're not one of those people who subscribes to the theory that there may be dinosaur fossils on the moon?
I don't think so. Although I did read a paper about that a couple of years ago, and I thought it was interesting. You can get some to get up there, but I don't think it's a whole lot. And I may be wrong. I may be misremembering that paper I read. I'm not, you know, an expert on this again, although maybe I should be, because this is actually Dealing Death, so I should know more about this. But, you know, you can't know everything. And so it's entirely possible.
Yeah, just how much uranium did they measure in these?
You know, I don't know. I don't have access to the journal they published in, which is really irritating. It's part of the problem of working from home and no longer being affiliated with the university. I don't have access to all the journals for free anymore. So if any listeners have it, hey, send it to me. Send me a
PDF.
So,
Phil, if there were active bacteria on the Earth and then the Earth got smacked by something big enough to throw enough matter out into space to form the moon, would there be any remnants of that bacteria for us to detect?
Probably not, because when the moon formed, I mean, that impact was a vastly huge impact. And we're talking about, you know, billions of megatons. I think that may be right. Millions of megatons, at least, of energy. And I'm guessing billions. I'd have to do the math. But it's a huge, huge release of energy. And so anything that was in that ejecta, anything that got smacked up into orbit, would have been heated to its melting point. And so I think that would have fairly well sterilized anything that got hit. You know, since then, we've had some pretty frighteningly large impacts. A billion years ago, I think it was the Sudbury impact in Canada, which is where there's a nickel mine there. It's left over from the asteroid that hit. And you can see giant impacts like that all over the Earth that probably were big enough to dust the moon with stuff. It's hard to say whether anything could survive that. You know, they talk about the Mars rock or rocks from Mars having bacteria on them, possibly. But Mars is only has about half the gravity of the Earth, and so it's easier to get stuff ejected into orbit. You need it's a less energetic event, and so it's not as unlikely, which is as you know, faint praise as I can give it.
So, Phil, as I said, this is the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing on the moon. And you had blogged about this rumor that I guess was started in a British tabloid, I think, that perhaps the long-lost videotapes of the Apollo 11 landings had been found. But alas, it sounds like this is probably a hoax.
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of conflicting information about that. Basically, there was a newspaper in England that said these tapes were found that had the data on them from the original broadcast of the lunar surface. When Apollo 11 touched down on the moon, they had a camera there that was attached to the side of the lander that is what was sending the signal back to the Earth so that we could see Neil Armstrong step off the footpad and onto the moon, is his one small step for man. Well, the data that was sent to us, it wasn't super high resolution, but there were all sorts of things that were done to it to make it not so good. And it was sent from the moon to a radio telescope in Australia, where it was recorded, and then at the same time also beamed to NASA headquarters. And what you see all the time, now I'm getting conflicting reports about this as well. I always was told it was a video camera that was aimed at a screen in mission control. Now I'm being told that's not true. I think it was Houston that they did this with. So we're not seeing an original, that fuzzy, awful, washed out video you see of Armstrong doing that. The original video would have been a lot better than that, basically, is what I'm trying to say. But the problem was that data was lost. Well, a couple of years ago, there were some tapes that were found in Perth, Australia. They were just stored there that had some data from later Apollo missions. And that was pretty interesting because that stuff had been lost for a long time. And that was telemetry data, scientific data, just encoded on the tape. Well, this British newspaper came out and said, well, it turns out these tapes have been found that have Apollo 11 stuff on them. And so I blogged about it, and I was careful. I said, you know, if this is true, you know, we'll find out more, because the article itself says that NASA would not confirm this. But the way they quoted the NASA guy made the NASA guy sound really cagey about it. Then I heard from some friends who would know, actually. They are space aficionados and people who study this stuff and talk to the experts. And they said, no, it's a hoax. One guy... there's something going on here. NASA is looking into this. I think that NASA is going to say something about this soon. They were planning on it anyway. And I suspect what they're going to say is, yeah, we did not find the tapes. We don't know what this guy was talking about. He just ran with the story. In fact, a top NASA press guy basically said that story is a fiction. That was the word he used. So it was fiction, not science. You could use that in your at the end of the podcast here.
Sure.
But I don't know. So the answer is I don't know. NASA may be hedging their bet. Somebody may be wrong. But it really sounds to me like this reporter just jumped the gun a bit and said a bunch of stuff which turned out not to be true. And I suspect what we're going to find out is that the lost tapes are still lost.
So, and these tapes only ever existed at the station in Australia for some reason? I mean, they didn't make copies. Was that done back then? And
I don't know.
Handed over to NASA?
I don't know how that all works. I mean, they recorded these things, and who knows? They were supposed to get shipped to NASA, but they got stuck in a box and then didn't get shipped. That happened back then, and people are having a hard time understanding that today, where you can just send information over the internet or, you know, burn a CD and ship it off. It wasn't like that in 1969. These tapes would have been stored someplace. They, you know, those giant racks of 9-track tapes, those, you know, 15-inch yeah. spools of tapes, they're all white. I used to use those. Yeah. Actually, I came in just at the end of that era in like 1988 when I was getting my master's degree, and I was constantly getting those tapes mixed up. And so I can't even imagine what it must have been like to have 1,000 of those hanging on a rack and trying to figure out which one was which and mislabeling one or whatever. It seems to me that it was incredible that any of these things got taken care of correctly at all. And so to have some of these things lost, even something as important as that, does not surprise me. It could have been as simple as somebody putting it on a table next to another tape and then somebody picking up the other tape and it getting lost that way. It really could have been that simple.
Or maybe Kirk accidentally took that tape when he was trying to cover up the
tomorrow was
the
yesterday
Enterprise. Yeah, in the past.
you're trying to sneak Star Trek stuff.
Who's
past
this
me,
Kirk guy you're talking about?
Got to try.
It was pretty blatant. I thought.
Phil,
although I can't remember the pilot's name now. Carey, was that right? Captain. His son was the leader of the first Titan mission. I remember that much. There you go.
Uh-huh. You're totally
there's my
dark,
Star Trek dorkiness for the day. Dang,
you got it. Hey Phil, I'm a little confused. Was this video just beamed down to the Earth and recorded, or was there an actual hard copy of this on the moon that was then blasted from the moon back down to Earth, or was it? How did that work?
I'm not positive of the details, but as I understand it, this to save weight, this was simply a camera that was hooked up to the antenna. And that video stream was beamed to the Earth, and it was recorded in Australia, and that's where the hard copy was made on one of these 9-track tapes. It was recorded as a data stream, and then you could encode it that way, and then decode it later. And that's what happened. It was the Parkes Radio Telescope in Eastern Australia, and if you've ever seen the movie The Dish. It's a cute movie. Sam Neill's in it, and Putty from Seinfeld. What's his name?
I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Somebody help me here. You know, this guy. Yeah. He was Kronk on The Emperor's New Groove. I can think of all his character names. I can't think of the guy.
Kronk.
How sad.
I love him.
He was the underdog. He was the Tick. Oh, my God. I know every role he's ever done. Can't think of his name.
The guy with the voice and the thing.
It's a cute movie, The Dish. They kind of conflated two different radio observatories in Australia and just had the whole thing set at Parkes to make it simple to film it. But that's basically what happened. You know, Australia was in the right position.
Well, hopefully some aliens intercepted the signal. Now they got a hard copy too, so.
That's true. If we just go 40 light years
fingers.
In the other direction, we can catch it.
That's right. With balsa wood and kids' scotch tape.
All fixed. But how cool would that be if we ever find those tapes? That would be awesome.
One comment I have is, though I don't get it, like definitely predictable historical footage. You know, it's not like after the fact somebody said that we may want to save this. Like they knew going into it, you know, this is huge. How could they possibly screw that up? How could they? You don't misplace stuff like that.
Clearly, because the moon landings were faked.
Right.
Yeah, you heard it here last.
Think about that.
Yeah, it just stuff happens. Look, you know, they think that Neil Armstrong screwed up his line on the moon. And so, you know, this stuff happens, and it sounds like such a stupid excuse. But nothing goes perfectly. I have been involved with high-level stuff with Hubble, and you realize, oh, I used the wrong piece of software. I did this. We were testing our camera on Hubble, and I used a bit of canned software to calculate how much light this lamp would give off inside our camera to calibrate the detector. And it was the wrong piece of software to use. And we were getting data from the camera, and it was just totally flooding this detector with light. And if you know, that could it couldn't damage the detector, but it's not hard to see a mistake like that really screwing things up. And that, you know, it just happens. You can't get everything 100%.
Yeah, I think people, like, when you're dealing with really high-profile, sophisticated organizations like NASA, people assume a level of competence that is really not realistic. They forget it's still just people who are running these organizations, who are susceptible to all the same kind of error proneness that we all are, and really ridiculous stuff happens. Like, what, didn't one of the Mars probes crash because of a metric and English system screw up?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right, and a piece was installed upside down on the Mars polar lander, and that's why it slammed into the surface at 100 miles an hour. You know, what are you going to do?
Beautiful.
If they can send a man to the moon,
they should be able to send a man to the moon.
Yeah, we should be able to send a man to the moon.
They should be able to send back the pictures.
Yeah.
Right. But the same thing is true. Like, in medicine, we run into this all the time. You think that, you know, you have really highly competent professionals. How could they possibly make a mistake? Well, you know, it's scary to think about, but they're just people.
Yeah, it's human beings.
You need systems. You need checklists. You need, you know, things in place to keep people from making mistakes. Left to their own devices, people will screw up on a regular basis.
Somebody has this film. And every year on the anniversary, he watches it, just him, and he just laughs to himself like nobody else has this.
Right, well, he,
that's
I've
my
got
theory.
Of video that nobody else
and
has.
That's why he dumps his cigarette ash into his Bigfoot ashtray and, yeah, like 10 other conspiracy theories at the same time.
Puts on his tinfoil hat. Yeah. Yep.
So, Phil, wasn't Tam awesome?
right now we're at Tam. This podcast is uploading on the Saturday of Tam.
Oh, cool.
So, Phil, isn't Tam awesome?
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything is running so smoothly.
It's too bad that SGU Live caught fire and had to evacuate the building. Other than that, yeah. Remember how Rebecca was late every morning to the SGU Live? That was great.
Yeah, but what's new?
Yeah.
One more funny item to talk about. The TV show Impact, a two-parter.
Oh, God.
That was on this last two Sundays. Oh, my. I think this is, at least in the running on the short list, if not the worst abuse of science in a TV drama ever. It was horrible.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, it could have been better.
I mean, there were
you know, first
like
of
so
all.
Many things to talk about. It's like we have to pick and choose the most horrible things to talk about.
Right.
We could spend 2 hours dissecting
it. I mean, Nastasha Henstridge is in it, and she's pretty cool. I actually like her.
Yeah.
She's holding up pretty well.
Some people say, yeah, she's really pretty. Fine. I've actually liked the stuff I've seen her in. Do you ever see She Spies? I still stand by that show, the first season at least. It was a satire on spy shows, and it was hysterical. And she was really funny in it. But yeah, she stars as an astrophysicist. And basically, I only saw the first part. I've not seen the second part. Not gonna, all right? Just to let you know. But there's the biggest meteor shower in 10,000 years, and so everybody's out looking at this meteor shower. And then they suddenly discover a giant piece of debris or something that's huge. It's miles across, and it slams into the moon. And it creates an explosion, and then pieces of the moon fall down and hit the Earth. I was actually rather surprised. The opening of the show, besides making sort of the standard mistakes of two people sitting next to the telescope in a brightly lit room, you know, you kind of want it dark where your telescope is so that light doesn't get in and destroy what you're trying to take pictures of, right. and instantaneous access to video from space and things like that. It makes a lot of those dumb mistakes, but the rest of it wasn't awful. You know, the meteor shower was depicted fairly well, and on that other stuff was okay. But this thing slams into the moon, it creates a huge explosion, stuff debris to the Earth, and then they find out that these impacts were much bigger than they should have been. They discover one crater that's like 20 feet across, but the meteorite in the bottom of it is only like 3 inches across, the size of a baseball, something like that. And it turns out it's this uber-dense material. It's uber-dense, there you go, just for you guys. And it turns out that the moon's orbit changes. And I was reading this, or I was watching this, thinking, the kind of impact it would take to change the moon's orbit would vaporize the moon. It's just a huge amount of energy you'd have to dump into the moon, so much so that it would make half the moon would be destroyed. But it turns out that that wasn't as bad as I thought, because what the moon got hit with was this giant, super dense material. Now, this part made me cringe. They called it a brown dwarf. They said it's a brown dwarf material. And I thought, no. And then this guy's astronomy student. I don't know if she was a grad student or an undergrad, but she says, "What's a brown dwarf?" And I thought, "Really? Really, you don't know what a brown dwarf is, and you're an astronomy student?" But
it's a poop.
It's a brown dwarf is an object that's like a somewhere between a planet and a star. It's like if you took 10 Jupiters and smashed them together, that would be a brown dwarf. And so it's a giant gaseous object. You can't really get a chunk of it. And then they started describing it, and the guy said, "Well, it's what's left over after a star like the sun evolves, blah, blah, blah." And I thought, oh, it's a white dwarf. They just got their colors mixed up. And so, yeah, so they just used the wrong object, which was painful to listen to. But what's funny is you can't have a chunk of a white dwarf. The reason a white dwarf is so dense is because of its gravity.
Exactly.
If you stood on the surface and took a shovel and picked up a piece of this stuff, it would explode. Because all that's holding it together is its own gravity. And if the chunk is too small, it won't have that gravity to hold itself together. And it would just, it would explode. It would be like it would be an explosion. That's the best way to describe it. Yeah. So you can't have a piece of the stuff hitting the moon. But even if you could, after that, their science was confused. They got some of it right. The moon's orbit would change. Basically, enough of this stuff hit the moon that it got so much more massive, it actually had twice the mass of the Earth.
Yeah, so hang on. So that's where I think that one of the biggest problems is, though. So first of all, if you have a small object, if we take their premise, which, as you say, is absurd, where you have a small object that's twice the mass of the Earth smacking into the moon, the heavier objects, you know, momentum is going to predominate, you know, over the lighter object. The way they had it, the moon's orbit initially didn't change at all.
Then it started changing.
Now, I would think that that thing would almost go through the moon, and if somehow it didn't go all the way through the moon, it would have radically changed the moon's orbit. Well, in fact, the Earth would have been orbiting around it more than it was orbiting around the Earth, right?
So that's right.
The barycenter.
Yeah,
would change.
The barycenter between the Earth and then this now 2+ Earth masses would have been closer to that object than to the Earth.
Right.
That's exactly right, and that was why I was laughing through the rest of the movie as I was basically fast forwarding through it. I hadn't thought about the fact that it might pass through the Earth or pass through the Moon right until just before you said it, and I was opening my mouth to say, you know, this stuff is so dense.
Yeah,
it might act. I mean, the moon would be like a vacuum, and it might pass right through, especially at interstellar speeds. This thing would have to be moving at huge speeds, and I'm talking about 100 miles per second or faster. And it's so dense, it might very well have passed right through the moon. But let's just say that it didn't, and the moon somehow were able to suddenly be twice as massive as the Earth. You would notice this right away. Basically, because the Earth would start orbiting the moon instead of vice versa, the sun would not make a simple arc in the sky. It would make all these crazy loops as the Earth was spinning and going around the moon at the same time. So they really screwed that up. It's not like it would be days later and people would be scratching their heads saying, "What's going on with the moon?" They'd be freaking out and saying, "What's going on with the sun?"
Yeah, right.
The Earth is going, all around the moon. Yeah, they kind of screwed that up. And then there were all kinds of crazy electromagnetic effects that wouldn't happen. Magnetic effects. This thing has a super strong magnetic field, and you see like a maglev train flying off into the air and people floating up. And it was, at that point, it was just, you know, flip the crazy, stupid science switch in the movie script. And it went totally off the rails at that point. I have no desire to see the second half because of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's like these local anomalies in gravity because of this thing. So yeah, people were just floating away. That was bizarre.
Yeah, the quote, I wrote down the quote, the one that really struck me. If the EM energy is powerful enough, it will override local gravity.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just...
That's also known as turning on a flashlight. You know, if you can't point a flashlight down and go rocketing off into the atmosphere, I don't think this is going to work either. In fact, if you were to take an object like the moon at its distance and give it so much more mass, basically the moon is an 80th of the Earth's mass. So basically you're multiplying its mass by 160 to give it twice as much mass as the Earth. The tidal effects on the Earth would be so severe. They would be 100 times greater, 200 times greater than they are now. There would be tsunamis and huge amounts of flooding. There would literally be tidal waves. And so you'd see like Indonesia would be wiped out and coastal cities would be flooded because instead of getting your normal 2 or 3 foot tides, you'd be getting 100 foot tide. That's maybe something somebody would notice. They made the tides, they mentioned the tides and say, "Ooh, it's getting bad." But, you know, they, as typical with these sort of disaster movies, they grossly underestimate just how bad these things would be.
It gives the term disaster movie a whole new meaning.
But yeah, you're right. They glossed over the tides, and then it's worse than just that the moon now, as you said, it's 180 times or 160 times the mass that it was. It also came a lot closer to the Earth eventually on the
right.
show. So, I mean, the tides would have been massive. It would have been scouring almost every tidal waves would have been scouring just about every place on Earth.
That's true. The size of the tides depends on the mass of the object. So if you add 160 moons to the moon, you have 160 times the tidal force on the Earth. But in fact, the distance is a much stronger force. It goes as the cube of the distance, or actually the inverse cube. So if you put the moon twice as close, half the distance it is now, the tidal force will actually be 8 times as much. And if it's 5 times closer, the tidal force will be 125 times as much. 5 times 5. There you go.
But let me tell you the part of this show that irritated me the most, as bad as all of that was just the way they depicted the moon after the impact. The moon was sort of cracked open.
Right.
And stayed that way. But also there was moon debris like hovering above the surface of the moon.
Right.
Just like floating there.
Right.
Because I guess they were thinking it's in space, so it's weightless.
Oh my God. Just floating? It wasn't in orbit?
Yeah, exactly. If the moon has twice the mass of the Earth, that stuff would fall twice, you know, not twice as fast, but significantly faster than stuff would fall on the Earth.
Right. I mean, even if it were just the moon mass, gravity would pull it all back together again.
And it was just floating there?
Just floating above the surface of the moon.
It would either fall back to the moon or be ejected into space, and it would billow away. And come to think of it, now that you say that, I'd forgotten about this. I was going to do a review of this, but it just wasn't worth it. In fact, as the moon gets closer to the Earth, it would not always show the same face to us. It shows the same face because the way it spins on its own axis and the way it goes around the Earth are locked. So it spins on its own axis once per month, and it goes around the Earth once per month. But as it gets closer, it's still going to be spinning once a month, but in fact, it's going to be going around the Earth faster than that. So it won't always show the same face, and they always depicted it that way. And in fact, if the collision were even a little bit off-center, if this thing didn't just slam straight down to the center of the moon but came in at an angle, it would actually spin up the moon or slow the moon's spin.
Right.
And one would assume there's some angular momentum here. Just like, again, if you take the cue ball at a pool table and hit another ball, you can make the other ball spin faster. So, you know, the moon would just be spinning around like a top, and they ignored that. Now, look, you know, that's at a level of anal retention that even I don't have, that I'm, you know, I wouldn't put that in. But it would be cool to have seen it. And the thing, the point I make over and over again is that scientists will know this stuff. And it's not that you're writing a script so that the scientists will know it. The thing is, a script writer doesn't know it. And so what they need to do is talk to a scientist and say, listen, I want to do this. I want to smack an object into the moon. What do I do to make this work? And then the scientists can say, well, this is what's going to happen. And there might be an idea in there that's cool that the writer will not have thought of. And it's not like, I don't care if the moon is spinning or not, but that might make a cooler graphic. That might be more interesting than just showing the face of the moon the way they did.
They consulted a scientist. They contacted Richard Hoagland to get his opinion
on
what would happen.
I just had a cool idea. It would be great if somebody actually made a computer graphic video based on this show showing us what would happen, giving these various scenarios that we're talking about. That would be interesting to see. All right, see this stupid movie? It got it all wrong. This is what would really happen. And then just show us graphically
what would really happen. A grant from the NSF to do that, though.
Yeah. Too bad.
Yeah, the thing is, good science makes the story better. And
you
know, this script desperately needed some scientists to tell them, you know, what day it is, because I actually thought it was a pretty horribly written drama. Forget about the science.
It was boring.
Yeah, I think it was really bad. So I think the writers here were not very imaginative. They probably were too arrogant to think that they needed scientist consultants or that it didn't matter. And the result was a pretty lazy script, I thought.
Can you imagine people around the water cooler talking about that the next day? Did you see that show, Impact? Yeah, look what will happen if this happens. Wow.
Well, that's what happened with the Fox Moon Hoax documentary, quote-unquote documentary, back in 2001. It got so much buzz at the water cooler that they ran it again a month later and got a bigger audience.
Oh.
And there are a lot of us who think that that movies and TV shows actually have an obligation to get the science right, especially when they're talking about medicine, because they're just out there spreading misinformation. Mm-hmm. And people remember that stuff. They really do. Surveys have been done to show that after people watch an episode of ER or something like that, they retain some of the information that was dispensed on that show. So they're really, in my opinion, they're obligated to get it right.
Yeah, and they don't know where it came from either. They go, well, isn't there something about, this? They just remember the factoid without necessarily remembering its source, that it was on a drama. And it becomes part of the public consciousness, Well, Phil, we look forward to actually seeing you next week when this podcast is up.
It's always awesome to have you on, Phil.
Oh, thanks. This was a lot of fun, as usual.
All right, good night, Phil.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And you all can play along at home. We have a theme this week, and the theme is pregnancy.
Ooh. Oh, cool.
Is everyone ready?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little slow on the uptake there.
Ready.
All right, here we go.
Guys can't get pregnant, but okay.
Item number one. Scientists determine that the best way to maximize the probability of becoming pregnant is to have sex every day.
Absolutely. That's true, guys.
Item number two. New research shows that greater than 90% of embryos used for IVF, in vitro fertilization, have chromosomal abnormalities. And item number three, epidemiological data reveal a dramatic decrease in maternal mortality rate in Europe over the last decade. Evan, please go first.
The one about having sex every day seems over the top obvious, but the best way to maximize the probability, I don't know. Something's not quite right there. Thought it had more to do with planning it as far as when the woman is ovulating and basing it around that. And there's like certain windows, either time right before that or after that. But hey, what do I know? I'm a guy. The second one, in which the research is showing that 90% of embryos used for IVF have chromosomal abnormalities. That's kind of scary, and I think the scariness factor kind of makes that true. We're all going to go, ee, when Steve reads that that's science. So I think that one's right. And then the last one is the data revealing a dramatic decrease in maternal mortality rate in Europe over the last decade. So what's been happening in Europe over the last decade that would lead to a dramatic decrease? Boy, that one's a little hard to fathom. It's either that or the first one. So I'll go with my instinct. I'll say the maximizing the probability of becoming pregnant to have sex every day, that one is fiction.
Okay, Jay?
Okay, the first one. Scientists determine that the best way to maximize the probability of becoming pregnant is to have sex every day. I think that's true for a number of reasons. One, I think I recall reading something about if a man ejaculates every day, the overall health of the ejaculate goes up. And you're more likely, because you're more likely to hit that day, which isn't, or that two or three day window where the woman is ovulating. Yeah, that's a no brainer to me. Second one, new research shows that greater than 90% of embryos used for IVF have chromosomal abnormalities.
CAs.
See that, Evan? That is an interesting piece of information there. I'm not sure about that. Item number three, epidemiological data reveals a dramatic decrease in maternal mortality rate in Europe over the last decade. Wow. That's very believable. I am going to say that I think that item number two, that 90% of embryos used for IVF have abnormalities, is the fake.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, having sex every day to maximize your probability, that seems like a no-brainer, but I think you mean that not that you're just, increasing the odds because you're having more sex, but some change happens that to maximize the probability. Like Jay said, say the amount of sperm produced, the amount of active sperm, that kind of makes sense to me when you look at it that way. 90% of the embryos have chromosomal abnormalities. Wow, that seems a little high. Yeah, I don't know about that one. And then the third one. Yeah, Evan, I agree with Evan that dramatic decrease. I don't know why. What would have happened in the past 10 years to warrant a dramatic decrease? And would epidemiological data be the best way to reveal that? I don't know. I'm going to say that one is fiction.
I'm tempted to change my answer, but I'll stick with what I said.
So you guys are all over the place.
Yeah, basically we don't agree.
Yes, three of you and three different answers. So I guess I'll take them in order. Item number one, scientists determine that the best way to maximize the probability of becoming pregnant is to have sex every day, and that one is very nice science. This actually runs contrary to the previous conventional wisdom, which is that you should, if you're trying to get pregnant...
Save up, right?
Save up. Yeah, not have sex every day. Maybe do every two or three days and try to time it to ovulation, but not do it every day so that you have more sperm in the ejaculate, and all, you know, more sperm all at once is more likely to cause fertilization than spreading it out over time. But it turns out that that basic underlying assumption is not true, and new data shows that having sex every day improves sperm quality and actually could boost the chance of getting pregnant. So there, this may mean that actually having sex every day is more likely to get you pregnant, and that we men should not, who are trying to get their wife pregnant, shouldn't wait every other day or every third day and try to time it that way. Just do it every day.
Has to be vaginal sex, by the way.
Let's go number two. New research shows that greater than 90% of embryos used for IVF have chromosomal abnormalities. Jay, you thought this one was the fake, correct?
Well, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, and this one is also science.
Yeah, it's science.
Scary. That's sad science.
That's 90%.
90%. Wow. Yeah, this is surprising. And this was a paper that was presented, so there's nothing published yet, but it was presented at the 25th Annual Conference of the European Society of Human Reproduction and Embryology today, July 1st, by Evelyn Vanest, who's a PhD student. And this is a bit surprising. The question now is, what are the implications for this for IVF, for in vitro fertilization, and especially for pre-implantation testing? Now, the article describing this study says that this could mean that pre-implantation testing may be counterproductive. That since most of the embryos that you're going to find an abnormality if you look, there's no point because you might end up throwing out completely viable embryos. But I don't understand that, though. To me, it would make it sense the other way, that this means all the more reason why we have to do pre-implantation testing to find those 10% that don't have any abnormalities, right, and use them. But I guess not all of the abnormalities would result in a problem, you know, that you could still have some chromosomal abnormality and still have that result in a healthy, viable pregnancy.
Yeah, you know, maybe you just, you know, end up looking like Evan, you know.
Yeah, like, but yeah,
still,
or,
you know,
or worse, like Jay. So that's interesting. We'll have to see how that pans out and what the actual implications are. So that's, you know, again, that's a very preliminary piece of data. We need to really see what that means. Which means that epidemiological data reveal a dramatic decrease in maternal mortality rate in Europe over the last decade is complete and total fiction. So congratulations, Bob.
Not science.
Complete? You made it up wholesale?
No. The news item is increasing age of mothers in Spain leads to rise in mortality rates. There's actually been a fairly dramatic increase in maternal mortality rates over the last 10 years. And that directly correlates with increasing maternal age. It said Spain since 1996 shows a 17% increase in deaths. That's huge.
That's dramatic.
That is. I mean, when you're talking about deaths, 17%, that's a large number. And again, that tracks, again, using epidemiological data, that tracks very nicely with increasing maternal age. The risk was three times greater for women between the ages of 35 and 44 than those who were younger.
Three times?
Three times. Most deaths were due to preeclampsia, which is a syndrome of high blood pressure protein in the urine starting in the, you know, middle to third trimester in the pregnancy. Actually, my wife had that with her second pregnancy, had preeclampsia. They had to move things along. You know, wow. The treatment for that is delivery. That's the treatment. She actually then developed eclampsia, which is during the delivery, and then they wanted to go as fast as possible to end it. So they obviously this needs to be studied further to see exact, you know, to better sort out the risk factors and see what could be done to get that number down again. But the fact is, people are waiting till they're older to have kids, and that's leading to more complications, both for the mother and for the children. You know, it's unavoidable.
So evolution dictates that women should be having optimally, maybe late teens, early 20s?
Well, before 35 at least.
35 seems to be the critical age.
Why?
Just, you know, before 30, that's when that's the steep part of the curve, as we say, when risks for pregnancy-associated problems really dramatically increase. For having children with trisomy 21, for example, or other, you know, chromosomal abnormalities, and now, according to this study, risk to the mother as well. Yeah, I mean, you know, biologically, you know, women can be fertile as soon as they go through puberty, right? 14, 15, you know, for most women. Probably in the wild, you know, before civilization, in the evolutionary milieu, women were starting to have kids in their late teens through their 20s, and that was it. Now, it's not unusual. It's more shifted towards the 30s and even into the 40s. There hasn't been enough time for evolutionary pressures to have any effect on that. It's interesting, you know, it's possible, of course, that over time women will get will be able to have children later without increased risk. That, I don't know, that maybe able to actually adapt evolutionarily through selective pressures to having children later. I don't see why that wouldn't happen.
We'll never get to that point.
Why not?
We'll have artificial evolution. We'll adapt ourselves.
Well, yeah. If you're gonna assume that technology is gonna trump evolutionary pressure,
absolutely.
But that, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. Even if the technology is available, it may not be utilized universally enough to eliminate any advantage to being able to have children later. We'll see. We're still evolving. You know, the notion that, you know, we're completely stable and not evolving has really been disproven,
right,
in the last 10 years or 20 years or so.
You know, I just had a discussion with someone about this. When you're talking about the fact that we're evolving, like if you took a human from 20,000 years ago and they were raised in modern society, how different would they be from a modern human?
Not at all.
20,000? Yeah, you couldn't tell.
That was still anatomically modern human, so you wouldn't be able to tell a difference. But you're thinking of evolution in kind of an old-fashioned way. I think it's better to think about it as changes in the gene frequencies in a population over time, right? So while
right.
any particular individual may not be very different from 20,000 years ago to now, they may fit right in with the population. If you look at the population as a whole, the frequencies of specific alleles of specific genes, the ones that we've been tracking, they're changing over time.
All right, but more specifically, has man's consciousness evolved? Has the mind changed?
That's kind of a hard thing to say. You know, the mind doesn't fossilize. But what we can say, for example, genes that are associated with a higher intelligence have been increasing in frequency in the population since we've been tracking it, which was, you know, initially kind of a surprising finding, but now we're finding that this is actually more the rule, not the exception, that, yeah, you know, gene frequencies change over time, even in very large outbred populations like the human species.
So are our heads getting bigger?
No.
Not necessarily.
Because I've seen some people with some pretty big noggins, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Certainly head size, if you're looking across species, you know, correlates with intelligence, or to be precise, the relative head size known as the encephalization quotient. But in terms of these gene frequencies, it has to do more with how the brain's organized, not just raw neurons. All right, well, good job, Bob.
Thank you.
Yeah, Bob. I'm going to take silver on that because I stated that I was going to choose that one.
Whatever you got you
well,
out
no,
of that.
You said you wanted to change. We didn't know which one you wanted to change to.
I was pretty clear in the beginning.
I believe
it was either going to be first or third.
That's true.
It was going to be that IVF.
Yeah, Evan's like, oh, I got it down to three. It's got to be one of those.
It's only a matter of math.
Yeah, sometimes it is just a coin.
That's always the you know, the rationalizations, the mechanisms by which we try to rescue success from the jaws of failure. Say, oh, that was going to be my next choice.
I'm a glass half full kind of guy.
Who's that noisy?
Well, Evan, play for us last week's Who's That Noisy?
Alrighty, here it is.
Yeah, I'm sort of like, I guess, Bob Dylan was when somebody said, why don't you sing other people's songs? And he said, well, he sort of came to that point where people expected him to sing his own. I guess I've done enough investigations now that I'm expected to talk about mine rather than Phil Klass's or somebody whose investigations I would probably garble and mess up.
And who was that?
Our dearest, one of our oldest, dearest friends in all of skepticism, someone we here at the New England Skeptical Society have had a relationship with for a very long time, Dr. Joe Nickel.
Joey Nickel, cool guy.
He's the man.
Yeah.
What a good guy.
He's
great. Hey, we haven't talked to him in a while.
Well, he's here at TAM right now.
We will be interviewing Joe Nickel at TAM live. And so we will look forward to that interview soon. I think he's had a book or two out since we spoke to him last time. So.
Oh, he's a prolific writer.
Yeah, very prolific. We'll catch up with
him. All of his stuff is great.
You hear that, Joe? We're coming after you.
And he uses a typewriter.
That's
not a computer.
Right.
Yeah, he's the real deal.
So, Evan, what's this week's Who's That Noisy?
Well, I'm glad you asked because I have it here in queue, and I'm about to press the button that's about to play this week's Who's That Noisy. And here it comes. That's it.
Oh. Thank you, Evan.
Oh, you're welcome.
Jay, give us a quote, man.
I have a quote. I have a funny little situation tonight. Okay, I have a quote tonight. This quote was sent in by none other than... Well, how about this? I'm doing it different tonight. Here's the quote. Even if you can't imagine the explanation, sister, remember there are things beyond your knowledge. Even if you feel certainty, it is an emotion, not a fact. Father Flynn from the movie and screenplay Doubt, written by John Patrick Shanley. Sent in by Drew Pruitt. Ornicello. How about that?
That was long.
Father Flynn, huh?
That's a good quote, though. You got to love a movie called Doubt. Haven't managed to see it yet.
That was last
good
year.
Good movie. I saw it. I saw it a couple weeks ago.
Oh, was it a few more?
Well, thank you, Jay. That is a good quote. I like that quote. Makes me want to see that movie.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, and Drew sent in the second half of it, and I looked it up. And I did a little research on it, and I added that first part in, which I thought balanced the whole thing better. It's actually...
Yeah.
Looks like an interesting movie. It's a screenplay and a movie.
It was a play that was made into a movie.
Yeah, sorry.
Right, screenplay by definition. Well, thank you all for joining me again this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Great to be here.
That's right. Next week's show will be the recording that we are making at TAM, which will have some interesting surprises.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks again, everyone, and until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.